Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Lindsey Buckingham's signature fingerstyle guitar is perhaps as recognizable as the countless classic songs he wrote while he was in Fleetwood Mac. Buckingham is a self-taught guitar virtuoso and songwriter who famously joined Fleetwood Mac in the mid-70s with his then-girlfriend Stevie Nicks. The band had been around since 67 with various singers, guitarists, and songwriters. The only constant was the rhythm section, drummer Mick Fleetwood and bassist John McVie. But the band didn't blow up until Buckingham and Nicks joined, writing mega hits for their insanely successful 10th and 11th albums, including the 20 times platinum Rumors. A lot of the songs were about Buckingham's romantic fallout with Nicks, and nearly half a century later, tensions between the two are still very much alive. In 2018, Stevie Nicks supposedly had Buckingham fired from Fleetwood Mac after he asked for some time away from the band to work on his solo album. On today's episode, Bruce Headlam talks to Lindsey Buckingham about that solo album. Buckingham also tells Bruce that he and Nicks never really got closure from the breakup, and how that affected their professional relationship in the decades since.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Bruce Headlam with Lindsey Buckingham.
So tell me about this album.
Well, you know, I have had this ready to go for 3 years at least. I had actually finished it, you know, right after Christine McVie and I did that duet album a few years back, and Christine and I had done a tour, and it was my intention to, you know, put this current album out back to back with that and do at least an American tour behind it before embarking on another Fleetwood Mac tour, which was already in the works. And I went and asked the band if I could have an extra 3 months before we started rehearsing for the Fleetwood Mac tour. And there was some resistance to that from at least one member. Mm-hmm. So it got put off at that point. And then, you know, a series of other things occurred in the interim that kept it on the shelf. You know, one was having a bypass surgery a couple of years ago. And then, of course, the pandemic, so, you know, which put everybody on hold. So, it, you know, it's been a long time coming. But as I say, it has been ready to go for a number of years, and it's nice to finally get it out.
You know, listening to it, there's a lot of different kind of songs. There's a lot of sounds. Three or four of the songs, if you told people these were like extra tracks from a kind of classic Fleetwood Mac album, they'd go, oh, yeah, that makes total sense.
Well, you know, it was funny because I was, and when I began working on it, I've always defined my solo work as being a bit more off to the left or a lot more off to the left and more esoteric. Obviously, in doing that, you lose a large chunk of potential listeners who don't really get what you're doing because it doesn't resonate with their preconceptions of you in Fleetwood Mac. But when I got, you know, into working on this album, I really was thinking about making just a straight ahead pop album, you know, with a few, you know, odd touches as well. But so you are correct that many of these songs do sound very much in the spirit of the style that I applied to Fleetwood Mac as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's others like Scream, which is the first song, which, you know, instantly when you hear the opening of Scream, you're like, oh, that's Lindsey Buckingham, play the guitar. You could blindfold people. Maybe. It's just like you. It just sounds like you. You know, that could be from Seeds We've Sown or other albums you've made. And a couple others I just want to ask you about. Blue Light, which I thought was just an outstanding track. And probably one of those that sounds closer to Fleetwood Mac than your solo work.
Yeah, you know, it's got sort of a shuffle kind of bluesy bass combined with something you might have found in Holiday Road, or I'm not really sure exactly how to characterize that. But again, the content of the lyrics is just about a long-term relationship and celebrating the fact that you go through all sorts of things and that all sorts of challenges can and do present themselves, especially the longer you're together. And that, you know, if the love and the clarity is there, that you will always rise above that and you will never succumb to, in this case, the blue light.
Okay. Now, your personal life is, I know you filed for divorce. Is it?
We have, but it's a work in progress. We're not really sure what we're doing. I mean, that was done at a moment in time. But I think there's a lot of interest with both of us to try to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea how many people actually file and never follow through. You know,
I didn't know that.
I didn't either until I was made aware of that.
I may file later today. I didn't know that.
Hey, you know, if you got nothing else to do.
Now, you grew up in Northern California.
I did, yes, around Palo Alto, Atherton, actually.
And was there a lot of music in your house growing up?
Well, you know, I can say with certainty that I would not be here now doing what I'm doing had it not been for my older brother. You know, I was an avid listener of the music that was in our household when I was very young, 3, 4, 5. If it wasn't children's records, you know, it was what your parents bought for themselves. So I was an avid listener of, you know, South Pacific soundtrack and some of my dad's Dixieland Jazz 78s or Nutcracker Suite or whatever they happened to have, you know.
It's funny you mention that because we had a Nutcracker Suite. We had Peter and the Wolf on the other side of it. And right. Those records were just magic when you were a kid.
Well, you know, Nutcracker Suite, all of those songs are actually, I see them as great pop constructions. You know, they're really very accessible, even though technically it's classical music. You know, I mean, they're very thematic and very sort of kind of structured as pop songs, you know, and yeah. I always loved that about that. Anyway, so I was already attuned to, you know, sort of a fine, attentive level of listening even when I was very, very young. But then when I was about 6, my older brother Jeff came home one day and said, well, there's this new singer. His name is Elvis Presley. And of course, I couldn't even imagine what this guy was going to look like. I was picturing like a Fred Astaire or something in a top hat and tails. I didn't know. So he started bringing home Elvis, he was an avid collector of all the early great rock and roll, whether it was Chuck Berry or Johnny Cash or Jerry Lee Lewis or Fats Domino. I mean, everything. So without my brother being such an avid listener, I never would have taken to the rock and roll. And it was such a revelation. And it's not an uncommon story with people our age where suddenly there was this music that was for us. It was not for our parents. And it was something brand new. And of course, that's when I started to teach myself to play guitar, ukulele first, and then eventually six-string guitar. And I just by buying a chord book and learning to play all of those rock and roll songs and so that I could sing and play them. Mm-hmm. It was an exciting time, you know. And what happened with the music in our house was that lasted 1960, 61, and it started to fall off in terms of the impact and the newness. And at that point, folk music took over for me. And I started listening to a lot of mainstream folk, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Kingston Trio, and learned how to finger pick, learned how to Travis pick. And that, you know, became that really informed the style of my guitar playing at that point.
So when you left high school and you did start pursuing, I know you went to college for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And you did throw yourself into the music business. What did your family think? Did they think, he'll give it a couple of years, we'll support him?
Well, it was kind of incremental because, you know, I only got into a band because I had been asked to play guitar at an assembly my senior year. And we did that. And then we all graduated. And then all of the people in that band ended up at San Mateo Junior College the next year. And we decided to get the band back together and to try to see if we could, you know, actually get some work. Because one of the keyboardist was actually a very skillful writer at age 18, you know. And at that point, we were looking for a different girl singer because the one we'd had moved away. And so that's when Stevie came into the picture.
You had known her in high school, is that right?
She transferred in as a senior to Menlo Atherton High when I was a junior. And so we knew each other. We'd met each other a few times at social events, and we both were aware that the other sang and played guitar. Mm-hmm. And there might have been sort of a very subtle mutual attraction, but, nothing that was played out in any way. And then she went off to college the following year, and I stayed and finished high school for one more year. So I didn't see her for a year.
Right.
You know, but we knew she was a singer and we knew she was at San Mateo where we were all at college. And so we asked her to join the band and she said yes. And at that point, we also connected with a manager who was a hustler kind of guy who was at going to Stanford, a guy named David Forrest, who actually was a very good manager for us at that point and started getting us gigs at high schools and clubs and things, or, you know, local stuff. And so, you know, the way my parents took all of this in was, as I said, to be supportive of it. We needed a place to rehearse, and they were willing to soundproof the garage and let us rehearse there 5 days a week. To my dad's, probably my poor dad coming home from work and having to listen to this stuff every night. But again, I was just doing it because it was two things. One, it was just an extension of my love of music. And I think the second thing was that after high school in 1967, when I graduated, that was, I started to deprogram a bit. I started to grow my hair out. And, the whole Summer of Love up in San Francisco was happening. And obviously the Beatles had a huge influence on the world. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I'd grown my hair out. And so I was starting to think of myself as someone who wasn't going to be probably what my parents expected me to be, although I wasn't actively thinking about a music career per se. I was just happy to be in a band and enjoyed the gigs we were doing and enjoyed the involvement of that band. And that lasted, you know, about 4 years, and we ended up trying to get a record deal and failed. But at that point, there was interest in Stevie and myself.
Had you written stuff by this point?
No, this is what I'm saying. I still had not written songs. And I'd been playing bass for 4 years. So when suddenly there was all this interest in Stevie and me, that's when Stevie and I got together and became a couple. And that's when I said to myself, I guess I've got to start writing songs and figure out how to do that.
I'm fascinated. When you sat down to write a song, did you like listen to a couple other singers, or how did you even begin to do it?
Well, I think there was, you know, again, I think Cat Stevens was a big influence at that time. I think some of the guitar work was influenced by Jimmy Page and the fact that he was really doing a good job of using acoustics and electric, sometimes in the same song. A song like Frozen Love, which is this big epic ending, you know, is sort of influenced by that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just kind of made it up as I went along. I had managed to get an old Ampex 4-track tape machine. And so in the kind of the mode of Les Paul, playing everything yourself, I started putting stuff down and combining tracks and, you know, which I still do today, right? Mm-hmm. But that was also a help in terms of, you know, figuring out how to write. And Stevie and I basically came up with an album's worth of material and worked on it probably for 10 months or a year, and then figured it was maybe time to shop it in Los Angeles. And we had one attempt at doing that, which was kind of led to more or less tepid responses, I would say. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, I still wasn't so driven that I would have done what Stevie suggested we do. Stevie said, Lindsay, if we're going to make a go of this, we've got to move to L.A. We've got to be where the action is, you know. And that's not something I would have done on my own, probably because I lived in one place my whole life and I loved Atherton and Palo Alto and the Bay Area in general. She, on the other hand, came from a family that got uprooted and moved almost yearly because her dad was quite ambitious and kept either changing jobs or kept getting promoted, which required a move from city to city. So she, you know, it was a much easier proposition for her to think about picking up roots and moving to L.A. So because it was the two of us and because I sensed that she was correct in her intuition there, we did decide to move to L.A. And luckily enough, Keith Olson, who was one of the people we'd met not too long before, invited us to stay at his house for a few months until we could find a place, and was also instrumental in helping us get a deal, and obviously was a brilliant engineer and co-produced the Buckingham Nicks album as well. So we picked up our roots and moved to L.A. And that, again, I probably wouldn't have done that without Stevie.
Mm-hmm. But then, because, you know, you're known as a studio guy, you're known as a producer and a great arranger, did you learn that through the process of that first record? When did that interest start?
Well, you know, I think I just had it in me, and that's all I can say. I mean, if I were to go back and listen to the Buckingham Nicks album, I think a lot of that holds up quite well, you know, in terms of the musical vision I had for that. And I was only 22, but, you know, I think it so much of it comes from having been oriented to music for the better part of my life and having started so young. And maybe even the fact that I, you know, was so self-sufficient as a guitarist and had taught myself to play. And I figured if I can do that, I can teach myself to record. I can teach myself to produce. And it all kind of came together in one kind of fell swoop.
We'll be right back with Lindsay Buckingham after a quick break. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades.
What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with more from Lindsey Buckingham and Bruce Headlam.
You've said years ago that just because you guys were so busy and there was so much around the band that you could never really process your split with Stevie Nicks.
Right.
And I don't know if that you've been married for a long time. You've got adult kids. But it's interesting to me that all these years later, part of the Fleetwood Mac show when you're there is people kind of watching that time in your relationship. She's singing Landslide and they're looking at you, or you're singing mm-hmm. The Chain. Are they looking at each other? I can't think of anything else in popular music like it. Maybe Simon and Garfunkel, if they ever sing again together. But it's this strange thing. Did you ever feel when you were with them, and God knows you might be again in the future?
Yeah, could be.
Are you reliving those feelings? Because that's what they're looking for.
Well, you know, I think you have to start with the fact that Rumours as an album was so appealing, not just because of the music, but because of the subtext and because of the fact that these songs, the unique, as you said, it's unique to have three writers, and it's unique to have three writers that were basically couples, mm-hmm. you know. So Christine's writing songs to John. Stevie's writing songs to me. I'm writing songs to Stevie. I mean, that the musical soap opera of that, the real life aspect of that being laid bare on vinyl at that time was irresistible. You know, thank God the music was as good as it was, because it you know, otherwise maybe the the album would have eventually been seen as only that.
Yeah, it created fabulous music, and people yes. do love the music. I'm not downgrading that, but
no.
Part of it is this little drama they're seeing on stage.
Yes, and people responded to that. I think they related to it in their own lives. And I think they respected the fact that somehow we were able to rise above all those difficulties in order to keep our eye on what appeared to be our destiny at that time, even though we didn't know what that destiny was, and to get on with what we needed to do as a band and creatively for the big picture. But in doing that, you had to kind of compartmentalize all your feelings. And, a therapist would probably tell you it's not the most healthy way to go about, getting closure, because I would have to see Stevie every day and I would have to make the decision to do the right thing for her, even though I was in pain. And there was never any physical distance to get closure. Mm-hmm. So, I think there are echoes of that that are still tangible sometimes that were still tangible on stage as recently as a few years ago with Stevie and myself, because those issues never really got resolved,
Mm-hmm.
They kind of got pushed under the rug and yet completely exposed to the world at the same time.
Yeah, you're like a shell-shocked soldier. They just keep sending them back to the front.
Right, yeah.
Does that anger resurface? Like, do you ever want to say, and now Stevie's, or, she thinks, well, now, Lindsay the jerk is going to sing a song about me. Right. Or is it all professional?
No, I think it's all sort of, you can take many steps back and look at it philosophically. And obviously for me, meeting my wife and having children relatively late, I saw so many people that I know who were trying to be rock and rollers and live the lifestyle and also be parents and spouses and failed at those. And I wasn't going to be one of those. So, I had that as well, to fall back on and to redefine myself. And so, I don't think there was ever a time when those feelings got, at least not for me. I can't speak for Stevie, She may still be working that stuff through. Sometimes I thought that some of her reactions to things and her involvement in what happened a few years back with the band, was somewhat based in that, but I don't know.
Yeah. It's just interesting that you did a terrific album with Christine McVie and it had all that kind of magic. And I don't know how well it sold, but I think, and I'm sure the tour went well, but if you announce tomorrow, I'm going to do an album with Stevie Nicks. I'm not saying this is happening, but you'd be on the front page of the New York Times. People,
yeah.
Even though it's 50 years old, people are like, they've just seized onto this in an incredible way.
Oh, it would be so circular and karmic. It would be crazy.
The story about how you two joined Fleetwood Mac is famous. Fleetwood was in the next studio. He heard your guitar playing. He was looking for a guitar player. But what interests me is when you joined, for example, there are whole books written about Lennon and McCartney and about the sort of psychology of their relationship, how they were friendly but competitive and they pushed each other to new heights. You joined a band that had three main songwriters, which is pretty unusual. And all three of you started to get better. Like if you look at, the top 20 Fleetwood Mac singles, all you guys have written a bunch of them, you, Christine, and Stevie Nicks. What was the dynamic like when you joined around songwriting?
It was interesting because if you look at the whole thing of us moving to LA and getting a deal and having that album come and go and connecting up with Fleetwood Mac, it all happened in a relatively short period of time. And clearly, Stevie and I were prepared for the opportunity that was coming our way, although, that opportunity had yet to really be defined. One of the things that was in our favor going into Fleetwood Mac was that we had been demoing songs for a new album. So all of my songs that are on that first Fleetwood Mac album and all of Stevie's, Rhiannon, everything, and there's one, Crystal, which was from the Buckingham Nicks album, but all of those were completely worked out and very much in the form that you hear them, minus the rhythm section of John and Mick, per se. And so there was no sense of having to interact to sort of make something happen because we all were somewhat self-sufficient. I will say I remember very clearly the first day of rehearsal that we had, you know, before as preparation for going in the studio to make that first album, that, you know, Christine started showing me some of her songs, and I immediately realized that one of my big contributions to Fleetwood Mac it would be as a musical leader, because she needed a little bit of insight and a little bit of guidance on some of her songs that I was able to give and to take them to, you know, fruition. A song like Over My Head, where we completely remade the bridge from what she had it. So, you know, the writing remained succinct, where each of us had our own process. There was never any sitting around and co-writing, but there was a lot of interaction in terms of record making, for sure.
Okay. And you all wrote alone. And then did you each present your songs to the group, sort of for your consideration? We'd like this for the next.
Yes.
And was it a good group to present to? Were people open things, or were they, who do you think you are? Or,
well, I think, you know, Mick drove a lot of that. Mick and Christine, especially, were very open to what we had. And you have to remember, Mick heard my guitar solo in Frozen Love, or maybe the whole song, which has a lot of great finger picking in it too, and asked me to join Fleetwood Mac based on that, you know? So he was an incredibly intuitive guy. And you have to realize that he and Christine and John had been keeping the band barely above water for a number of years. You know, they'd had this brilliant beginning with Peter Green, and then Kiln House was great with Christine and Danny Kerwin. But, you know, there were all these albums that were in between, which were kind of non sequiturs from album to album style-wise, because different people kept floating in and out of the band. And the reason that happened was because Mick was intent on making sure that the band stayed together and stayed alive at whatever the cost. And also Mo Austin, who was president of Warner's at that time, I give him a ton of credit for even keeping him on the label. It's not something that you would find happen today. If your bottom line is not, you know, something you can make the boardroom happy about, you're going to be off the label. And in those days, he had the not only the intuition, but the autonomy to make a choice about Fleetwood Mac and say, I'm just going to leave him on the label because, you know, there's something good here and let's just see what happens.
It's interesting that today there's no way that band would have reached that level where they would have brought you and Stevie Nicks in and had the kind of success.
That's right. They would have been probably disbanded by then. So, you know, those kind of happy accidents are much fewer today. So, you know, I mean, I think Mick in particular was very, had a great sense of overview about which material to choose and what would make a great overall album. And there was never any sort of territoriality about that, any cynicism about that. I mean, the closest thing I can remember to anything like that was just a side comment from John to Mick one day where I think he was talking about the song Blue Letter or something that was, you know, relatively California, if you want to call it that. And I think he said to Mick, well, it's a long way from the blues, you know, but, you know, he was into it. Everyone was into it. We could tell immediately there was this great chemistry.
You were also the arranger. What would you do with a song like, you know, Dreams or something that Christine brought in? Were you the one who sat down and said, well, I think the solo should go here, or why don't we try this sound?
Totally. On a song like Dreams, if you heard it the way Stevie brought it in, you know, because she wrote it on the piano. Mm-hmm. And basically was playing it with like two fingers, you know, these two chords back and forth, the same two chords for the whole song, which is great. But it was so in need of delineation. Mm-hmm. It was so in need of one section being set apart from the other, because there was the potential for a chorus and a passing section and a verse. But none of that was framed or was set up. So, you know, all the orchestration that you hear on a song like Dreams was just something that came out of my head, you know, because I understood what the song could become, you know, if you took those sections and treated them with a sense of departure from one to the other. So therefore, you got, you know, a fairly empty verse with just sort of answering licks, and then you got a passing section where it's building tension, and I'm doing this up and down picking thing, and then it hits into the chorus, which is, you know, a chorus must have a sense of arrival. Then the harmonies come in and other instruments kick in, and it's just a thing, you know.
What was it like for you in particular to work with Mick Fleetwood? Because he, like you, I don't think he'd ever had a lesson.
No, never.
He's a very intuitive player. I think I've heard you say in the past that he never plays the same thing twice.
That's right.
Which is it must be a little maddening at points. How did you guys get along? Because, you know, you mentioned Dreams. When I think of that chorus, I think if he comes in a bit late on that big cymbal crash. And it's such a big moment in that song.
Right.
It's all feel. It's not, I don't think anybody else would play it that way.
No. I mean, I completely related to where he was coming from and how it was all intuition and feel for him. And he and I were and are kind of soulmates because of that. You know, we both love the same things about music. If there's anything frustrating for Mick, it's that he's got so much inside that he feels and is not articulate enough musically to express, you know. I mean, he could probably be a great writer, but, you know, he's certainly the best drummer I've ever worked with.
It's interesting. He doesn't know how to write a song.
Well, he'll come up with certain raw ideas, and they all have a sense of soul to them, you know. But there's hardly ever anything like completion, you know, because it's just not part of his DNA in that sense. But he's a magical guy. Mm-hmm. He's always been someone who was amazing with the overview and yet was in some ways timid about what he could and couldn't do, which is part of what makes him great, because what he does do is just so natural and so it just flows, you know.
Well, also, there'd be a lot of leaders of bands, you know, particularly a band like Fleetwood Mac that had some success. It may have been back on its heels at that point. Not a lot of people would say, well, let's get Lindsey Buckingham, and he says we've got to bring his girlfriend along. Like, that was a pretty radical change for the band.
It was.
And he could see that, and probably a lot of band leaders wouldn't have.
Well, yeah, and you have to give him credit for when I said, you got to take my girlfriend too, for him saying, okay. And you got to give Christine credit for that, you know, first, do I want another girl in the band? Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I think there was this, again, this sense that there was something unique about it that we couldn't quite define yet. It was all done on intuition. I mean, our decision to join was done on intuition. It wasn't a clear cut big break for us. You know, we weren't sure that it was the right move to make at first because we didn't know where Fleetwood Mac was going. But, you know, it did become clear fairly soon that the chemistry was amazing and that the synergy was creating something greater than the sum of the parts. You know, I mean, that first album only took four or five months to do. And what came out of that, you know, we hit the ground running. It was crazy.
You know, part of that synergy is your vocals with Christine's. Now, I know everybody, mm-hmm. because of the romantic relationships, they talk about the band in terms of you and Stevie. But when did you realize how well your voice melded with Christine's? Because there's something, and you guys did an album a couple of years ago, and that magic is instantly back. Your voices right. sound fabulous together.
I know. It's weird. I think it's because Stevie has a much more defined style with her vibrato, and it's a bit nasal. And when I would harmonize with her, to some degree, it just created a different thing. Christine and I were almost, we both had slightly more deadpan approaches to singing. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you put that together side by side, it just creates a kind of a symmetry which really shines and is so balanced, you know. I think that's what it is.
So after Rumors, you did Tusk, which was very much your project, and it's what people associate you, you know, the guy in the studio kind of, you know, diagramming it all out, very, very precise, mm-hmm. in a way that working with Fleetwood Mac always seemed a little bit chaotic.
Yeah.
When you talk about your own, when you do your own albums, you do all the instruments. It seems like a very, seems like a different side of your personality, the very precise side.
Mm-hmm.
Is it kind of a relief after all the Sturm and Drang around Fleetwood Mac to say, okay, I'm just going to sit in the studio and do it the way I want?
Well, I always thought of the processes as being two different things. I always felt that working with Fleetwood Mac was probably more like making a movie because, you know, you come in, you've got songs, you've got certain preconceptions about things, but everything is kind of more political and more conscious in terms of the choices you're making. There's a lot more talking about what you're doing. And working on my own is probably more analogous to painting because you are probably putting yourself in an environment where you potentially are going to be able to discover more things. Because as a painter does with his canvas, you know, you're sort of one-on-one. And at some point, wherever you think you're going, you might get led in a different direction by what's going on the canvas. And so those two things, I think, are both important for me. And, you know, the Tusk album in particular, obviously, it's been said before, but I was really just motivated to make that change from Rumors because Rumors was so successful that at some point the success detached from the music and kind of became about the success. And I think we were poised to possibly start to paint ourselves into a corner because, you know, the kind of the corporate formula is if something works, run it into the ground until it's dead and move on. And that's not really the formula to try to aspiring to try to be an artist in the long term. You've got to continue to take risks and to follow your heart.
Yeah.
And not do what the external world is expecting you to do. And so that was really the psychology behind the left turn that I orchestrated on Tusk, you know.
It's quite an insight you had because anybody else would say, well, we're doing Rumors too.
Right.
And I'm sure Warner Music thought you were doing Rumors too.
Oh, yeah. I would love to have been a fly on the wall when they first put Tusk on in the boardroom. And we're probably going, what the hell is this?
But it's an interesting, people argue about Tusk. And I know it's maybe your favorite album of your Fleetwood Mac records. But it's a great insight that you thought, no, we got to change. At the height of the insane success you guys were having,
mm-hmm.
were you listening to other music and saying, no, music is changing and we're going to fall behind. We're going to look like, you know, we're going to look like Dean Martin or something if we keep doing this stuff?
Well, maybe in a small way, but I think as successful as Rumors was that there were things that we didn't cover in terms of breadth or depth or just risk-taking that I felt strongly about. And you do have to layer on top of that the fact that right around the time, you know, the year or so before we started doing Tusk, that all of the new wave stuff had come over from the UK and Europe and the, you know, the new waves from America too. So there was, it wasn't so much that stuff influenced me per se. What it did do was it just reinforced what I was already kind of feeling, and it gave me more courage to act on it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were there particular acts or sounds that you found captivating or helped convince you this was the right way?
Well, I mean, again, there's nothing that I could say was directly influential, but I mean, I loved Elvis Costello and I loved The Clash and I loved The Police and I mean, I loved kookier things like Devo, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was all stuff which was undermining the status quo in one way or another. And I just felt that we were at a point where we might, again, start painting ourselves into a corner. And you see a lot of artists who do that and they do follow through with solely the external expectations. And they start to forget who they are. They start to forget why they got in the business in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's if you're not protective of your creative world and you start to let it go, it's a lot harder to get it back.
How's it been dealing with Warner over the years then for that reason? You know, I know there was a time I can't remember what solo album it was, but the label wanted you to hold off and they wanted some of the songs for Fleetwood Mac. Have you found they've been as accommodating, or do you always feel the pressure to, like, can't you guys just do Rumors again and make us $1 billion? Is that so wrong?
Well, you know, it sort of came, the kind of retro reaction did not come from Warner. It came really from Mick and the band. But yes, and I'll get to that in a second. But no, Warner, my experience with Warner has always been good, because the people that were there, whether it was Mo Austin or Lenny Waronker, I will say that I always felt like they didn't quite know what to do with my solo albums. And again, I can't blame them for that, because the albums are not Fleetwood Mac albums. And I think they were probably sometimes as baffled by some of the content as the fans were. And that's a choice you make. You know, if you're going to pursue something that's going to help you grow artistically that maybe you can't do in Fleetwood Mac, and you lose 9/10 of your audience doing it, then you've made a choice. But, you know, the idea of going back to a Rumors 2 or something more conservative was actually orchestrated by Mick himself. Because what happened in the post-Tusk environment was that the band had gotten very drawn into the album when we put it out and was very happy with it. But when it, and it was a double album, right? But when it didn't sell another 16 million, and I think, you know, as a double album, it probably initially sold something like 4. And so Mick came to me one day and he said, well, Lindsay, we're not going to do that again. You know, because I was working out of my house and I was bringing in tracks that I had started and having them add stuff to them and sort of combining the movie making and the painting. And there's some pretty, you know, experimental things on Tusk,
yeah,
especially of mine. And so Mick put the kibosh on that. And it was really only then that I started making solo albums, because I realized that if I were to continue to explore the left side of my palate and was being prevented from doing so in the context of Fleetwood Mac, the only way I could do it was on solo albums.
Mm-hmm. But you did hits on solo. I think your first album had Trouble, which was a big hit.
Trouble, and then there was Go Insane on the second one. But, you know, they've been a little fewer and far between. And obviously, my drawing power on live shows is completely different, you know. Mm-hmm. Although I will much rather play a theater than an arena, just right, aesthetically, you know. So
we have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Lindsay Buckingham. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. We're back with the rest of Bruce Headlam's interview with Lindsey Buckingham.
People know, you know, about the all the drama around rumors and the couples breaking up and everything. Those are very well-known stories. Mm-hmm. I was amazed to read that I think on the first time you left the band, it was 87, maybe? Was it after Tango, I think?
Yes, that's right.
That, you know, you said you left in part because the drug use was so heavy. And I think something about, like, Mick was living in a trailer on your lawn or something.
What happened was we recorded the Tango in the Night album at my house. I had a studio in what had been my garage. And the alcohol and substance intake, which had been a part of the subculture for everyone, you know, for years, it was starting to hit critical mass, you know. Mm-hmm. So during the making of Tango in the Night and trying to produce that album, it got to be quite difficult because people just weren't all there some of the time, physically or mentally. And I think out of the X number of months, probably close to a year that it took us to make that album, we probably only saw Stevie for a few weeks. And Mick was actually living in a trailer for quite a while in my front yard because he didn't want to drive home at night when the sessions were over. So, yeah, I mean, and so when we finished with the album and I was quite happy with the result, I felt we'd triumphed over adversity to a point, and I'm still really proud of that album.
Had a bunch of hits, that album.
Yeah, and it had elements of what I'd learned. You can make a connection between some of the tonality of, like, Go Insane and Tango in the Night. And so I was happy with that, but then I started thinking about the road and how the road, in terms of craziness, is usually about times 10 what the studio is. And I thought, I don't think I can do this. You know, I think I need to make a little survival move here. And so I opted out of the tour, much to everyone's disappointment. But, you know, clearly it was a good thing for me at that time. Yeah.
Your other long relationship in the music business is with Irving Azoff, uh-huh. who, you know, was your agent. But he's the one who phoned you a couple of years ago and said they don't want to tour with you anymore. I mean, was that weird to hear from the guy who'd been represented? Wait, is he your agent or is he the band's agent? Or?
Well, he was my manager for a number of years. And he was an agent in the sense that he was involved in putting together Fleetwood Mac tours and was taking a cut of those tours. So in a sense, he was an agent for the band, but he was my manager. And I would have to say about Irving, I mean, I like Irving, but, you know, he probably never would have gotten involved with me just for my solo endeavors. In fact, out of all the time that we worked together, I think he came to one solo show of mine.
Really?
And you know, obviously Fleetwood Mac was where the money was. Mm-hmm. And he's, shall we say, been known to follow the money. And so if you backtrack to this whole the atmosphere that was created right before that, which was actually brought on by what I was talking about before, about my asking for those 3 months to tour before the Fleetwood Mac tour started. That was the beginning of the tension that led to what certain members, or member, I should say, eventually orchestrated. And Irving, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, I think he was as invested in the Fleetwood Mac tour at that point as he was in protecting me. Mm-hmm. And so when someone in the band calls him and tells him, I don't want to be on stage with Lindsay anymore, I found in that circumstance, he wasn't really standing up for me. He was, you know, passing on information, but he was arguably throwing me under the bus a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was how our relationship ended, because after that, even though I expressed some interest in continuing to work with him, it didn't happen. And so, you know, that was it with Irving.
There's one song on the new album that is about Fleetwood Mac, On the Wrong Side. Can you tell me a bit about writing that?
Well, I think I was just in a situation where I had already begun to feel that some of the ethic that you could say was sort of shared by everyone was sort of moving too far away from my idealism, which I was still maintaining. And, you know, the older you get and the more it just becomes a gig or a job, and the more that you have played that same group of songs over and over again, so, you know, you see people start to kind of give up the possibility of growth on a creative level. And, you know, different people wanting different things also plays into that. I mean, you get the interband politics, which can often thwart a greater potential that we might have had as a band, maybe to go in and make another album or to do many other things. And I think all of that was starting to make me feel like I'd been in this game now for so many years and wouldn't have traded it for the world, but that it was this high pressure kind of situation that I was starting to feel I was getting a little tired of and was losing touch with a little bit. And it sometimes made me feel that I was a bit on the wrong side by being a part of it.
Mm-hmm. So you're going out on tour with this album. What's that going to feel like to go out and play in front of people after all this time?
I'm not sure what it's going to feel like. You know, we've only been in rehearsal for about 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And probably this week we will start running the set, the whole set that we've got, once or twice a day. And, you know, I mean, it's been a long time. I'm not sure if the bypass I had a couple of years ago is going to have any effect on my stamina. You know, there are some finer points that are still yet to be revealed about it. But beyond that, and of course, you know, it was very surreal sitting around for a year plus during the pandemic, as it was for everyone. So, you know, it just feels like it's been so long since this album was actually done, and so much has happened that's been, shall we say, challenging. So, I mean, I feel like I'm a different person than I was when I first wanted to tour this album 3+ years ago. So it is going to be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Okay, well, people should go see it because it's a great album.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's just been terrific to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Lindsey Buckingham for taking us through his musical history. You can check out his new self-titled album, plus all of our favorite Lindsey Buckingham and Fleetwood Mac songs at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast. We can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin Industries, consider becoming a Pushnik. Pushnik is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushnik exclusively on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
MuseAura is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of MuseAura. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to MuseAura.com, MUSORA.com, to start a new musical journey today.
It all started with two federal agents who heard a rumor.
She mentions, well, there is this alleged murder to have taken place.
There was just one problem. They had no clue who the victim was.
We have to do our job, and we have to find out, who did they kill?
It had been 15 years since this alleged murder. Was it still possible to unearth the truth?
I used to watch the Unsolved Mystery shows, and I often thought about calling, because I was like, this is not right. How can a person get killed and no one knows anything?
I'm Jake Halpern, and this is Deep Cover, The Nameless Man. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to hear the entire season right now, ad-free, subscribe to Pushkin Plus on our Apple Podcast show page or on pushkin.fm/plus.